push me and fire couldn't burn. These are the things that I never will learn. These are the things I never will learn.
From newsounds.org and the studios of WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck, our series of live performances and interviews. I'm John Schaefer, and everything I know about tardigrades, the tiny animals also known as water bears, I learned from Cosmo Sheldrake. Not that he's a biologist, although his father Rupert and his brother Merlin are both eminent biologists. Cosmo didn't go into the family business, but he didn't go that far either. His songs are full of references to nature and, in fact, are often built on the sounds of nature. That tardigrade song was 9 years ago, and it's taken that long for us to get Cosmo Sheldrake back to our New York studio, but he's here with all his gear and a brand new album called Eye to the Ear. That was inadvertent poetry. Here's his song called Stop the Music.
Stop the music, I'll have the whole thing. Those mountains, we can share the barnacles. Split the difference, I'll take the treetops. The we can share the molecules. We'll be overcome by morning at the dawning of the day. We'll be overrun by madness and the darling bats of day. We'll be overcome by morning at the dawning of the day. We'll be overrun by madness like the darling bats of day. Stop the dancing, we'll share the whole pie. The night sky, we can share the particles. Ask the question, you'll find the whole thing. Those mountains, just listen, it'll be wonderful.
That is Cosmo Sheldrake live here in our studio with a performance of his song Stop the Music. It is from his brand new record called Eye to the Ear. Cosmo, I've always had this experience listening to your music over the years, whether live or mostly on recording, and that is I can't stop grinning. Even on a song like that, which you know, when you listen to the words, it's kind of an emotional roller coaster. Mm-hmm. You know, in one line, it's going to be wonderful. Mm-hmm. And in the next line, we're going to be mourning at the dawning of the day, which is a cute play on words. The sound world that you create, mm-hmm. how does that begin?
I mean, it really depends. It's different for every tune, but I often think it's important to try and set pieces somewhere. So in my mind, it's like if I was to paint a portrait and it would just be a head with no neck or body and it would just be floating in void, it was always going to feel a bit odd. So So for me, it's important to always set the piece of music in a place or a location, and often that involves making a kind of bed of sound or right. Or a particular location or a place. So often it starts there, and then sort of textual elements will kind of emerge. But it's different. It really is different every time.
A lot of your backing tracks have this charmingly kind of DIY, homemade, almost rickety sound to them. And some of them are recognizable. I mean, we hear strings. We hear what's clearly chopped up bits of your voice. Mm-hmm. But then there are other things that are much more difficult to figure out.
Very much so. Yeah, there's all sorts of layers of stuff going on in there. Yeah, it's a... I think I like to think of making music as a form of collaging and sort of mixing right. and chopping and pasting and weaving together stories, new stories out of older ones or different ones.
Well, now you talk about setting a song in a place. You're out in the field often, like with a recorder in hand?
Very much so, yeah. I've spent quite a lot of time on various expeditions, field recording and some sort of recording of soils and others just with birds and others with a hydrophone in the water. So yeah, a whole bunch of different techniques for gathering sounds which then work their way into the music. Yeah.
Right, and some of them are more obvious than others. The song Breathe Round Corners, for example, the bird songs there mm-hmm. is pretty clear.
Absolutely.
Breathe round corners, dusts come sooner, we'll wallow the solitude away. Sit and watch as we get older.
Do you make your own recordings for the most part, or do you, I mean, there are many other, there's a whole library of sound out there.
Absolutely. I mean, a bit of both. So there's some, I try as much as possible to use my own recordings, but then sometimes when I'm just, you know, I don't have a parabolic dish or I haven't spent enough time close enough to that particular cookie or something. So in situations like that, when I'm really rummaging for a specific sound that I haven't got a clean enough one of myself, then I'll often source it from some archive or a friend or some sort of place.
Right. Are you familiar with Bernie Krause?
I am, yes. In fact, we've worked together a bit over the years and he's very kindly sort of... some of his recordings feature on the Eye to the Ear.
Really?
Some of his... There's a recording of a raven that he made in Algonquin National Park that features on 3:30. Sorry.
Used to walk my bodies away. I'm in the garden 4:30, underneath the hawthorn, watching as the ants go on.
Well, you know, one of the things that he did on this show some years ago was he brought in two recordings of the same meadow in Oregon.
Lincoln's.
Oh, you've heard this?
It's a striking recording.
Yeah, and they're recorded like, well, I think it was 5 or 10 years apart.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, in the intervening time, human activity in this meadow has forced the birds to change not only their habitat, but the pitch of their song.
Totally. That's a very striking example. He went before and after a selective logging exercise. There's some logging company that was doing some selective logging. So they recorded before in the similar conditions in spring and then after very similar conditions in spring and then over subsequent years and then turned those images into spectrograms and yeah, just revealed that what little changes to the eye. So the occasional tree, it didn't have a huge impact. It wasn't a clear cut log, but it had a dramatic impact on the soundscape and on the biodiversity of the area. And you could tell that by listening to the sounds. Whereas the eyes, you wouldn't be able to tell that much. It would still look reasonably similar. So it's just a testament to how the power of sound and studying and observing the kind of health of biodiversity and ecosystems.
Right. And growing up in a family of biologists, you would have grown up attuned to this. When did it become apparent to you that you were going to take it in a musical direction?
Well, my mum, Jill Purse, is a musician, and she's teaches...
Your mum's Jill Purse?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Stockhausen?
Yes, so she was with Stockhausen for a while. They traveled together for years and worked together in various ways.
Wow, you are from some family then.
So I've grown up very much with the kind of experimental music sort of thing, and she has, you know, she teaches Mongolian overtone chanting and various vocal techniques. So there's always been, you know, lots of strange sounds kind of coming through the household on account of her and through that. So music's, and also my dad's a pianist and his father was an organist. And so there's, and my mum's mother was a concert pianist. So there's a kind of long, there's lots of music even, and my brother, who's still a biologist, he plays the accordion and the piano. So there's music through and through, I suppose. So,
yeah. Well, now, you know, if you were sampling any of those people and using them on the record, you'd have to, you know, give them credit. They'd have to get royalties and stuff like that. What do you do when you're sampling birds and insects and soil and trees?
Well, it's a very good question. But so the last two projects I worked on was I released a EP called Wild Wet World, which is all incorporating sounds of the ocean, so recordings of fish and whales and other sea mammals and all sorts of things. And so for me, it felt important that the music was made from the voices and from the vocalizations or sounds that these animals and ecosystems make. So it felt totally and utterly essential that they should also be recognized in terms of the publishing splits, because publishing traditionally is the part of the royalty that deals with songwriting. Mm-hmm. Who owns the song, who wrote the song. So I split 50-50 the publishing royalties on Wild Wet World, and also Wake Up Calls, the album I did before that with Endangered Birdsong. 50% of the publishing royalties is then distributed to a variety of conservation organizations working with the ecosystems and creatures involved. And so, likewise, on this record, in the tunes that feature specific ecosystems or animals, there are some royalty structures and arrangements in place to, as much as possible, be able to send the royalties back to the co-collaborators or co-creators, that in this case maybe birds or animals and fish.
All right. The album is called Eye to the Ear, and that line comes from a song that I want to ask you about in a little bit, but the song you're going to do next is called I Did and I Don't and I Do. I do not understand that title.
Fair play. Well, so my wife Flora and I have a band together called Don't. And our first song was called Did, and okay. Then our second song was called Did, Don't, Do. So this, just to make matters even more confusing, is a kind of homage. It was a song that I wrote for her, and it's a kind of homage to Don't. And so I Did, I Don't, and I Do is a reference to some of our Don't music and some of the pieces we've made together. And also just one more thing I'll say about the royalty structures. Across the album, I'm also working with an organization called Earth Percent. And it's a charity started by Brian Eno to try and get various elements of the music industry to build into their structure a kind of a way that it's not just purely extractive industry, that some money then goes back to the conservation, and because even obviously streaming and emailing and stuff has a footprint. Exactly. So yeah. So it's somewhat to rectify that. So across the board, there's also part of the royalties that's just going back to Earth Percent, and then through their grant partners, a bunch of different conservation organizations.
Okay. It'll be a negligible addition to your carbon footprint for me to send you back to the table in all of your gear. Mm-hmm. Let's hear Cosmo Sheldrake once again with a live performance of a song from the new record called Eye to the Ear. This song is called I Did and I Don't and I Do.
Up a hole for you, come trickling downwards with me. Mechanical clouds, it seems, deliberate. deliberately blinding me, making it hard to see. I'm bound in a book of leaves, come trickling downwards with me. Come close to me, come close to me, come close to me, come close to me, come close to me.
I did, and I don't, and I do. Short song from Cosmo Sheldrake from the new record called Eye to the Ear, which is actually full of a lot of short songs, things that don't overstay their welcome. There are a couple of instrumental tracks, and Cosmo, if you peel back the unusual sounds and just listen to the rhythms, and I was thinking of this as you were playing Stop the Music, it's like some of the rhythms are actually kind of familiar sounding, you know. Stop the Music had a kind of South American flavor to it. Mm-hmm. There's something naggingly familiar about this tune that I'm not quite putting my finger on. I mean, are you aware of that as you build these?
I suppose there's in a way it's a way of, I just think it's good practice to kind of pay homage to the things that are explicit influences, and so. Yeah, I don't try and disguise things. Like, I suppose that one's got quite a dubby kind of feel. There's a little dubby edge to it.
Yes, yes.
I think it's just because I was playing with the synth. I just bought a Juno, and it was just such a wompy sound. It just led me in that direction. And also the Juno, and I also have a Space Echo. So it's just the two things together just led me down a dubby place, and that's the song that came out. Also, the frogs themselves had a kind of dubby, wompy element.
I didn't realize those were frogs when I heard the record. I mean, they just sound... They don't sound like... What American, what a good American frog sounds like.
Certainly not. No, not like any frogs I've heard.
So, the album is called Eye to the Ear, which is a line from one of the songs on the record, Eye to the Maybe Go. Syntax. interesting. But that's not your voice. Who sings that?
So no, it's a great friend of mine, a wonderful singer called Bunty.
Many hoops, many beeps, many windows keep calling for me. Beep, 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 overrunning. Beep, 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 overrunning. Then you're gone.
She's on two tracks on this album and then one of the last tracks in the last album.
Okay. And that line about, you know, eye to the ear, I mean, connections between our body and nature. I mean, that seems to be a pretty consistent thread in a lot of this music.
Very much so, yeah. And I think something of that, the sentiment of the title, The Eye to the Ear, there's an amazing book that I read a while ago called The Eyes of the Skin by Julian Palazmari, I think. He's an architectural historian. And it's a kind of history of the senses and phenomenology and like the idea of embodiment and how basically he's talking about how architecture and how the world is so rarely designed with any of our senses really in mind, other than the visual senses. Like cities are designed to be looked at from a distance, but not to be inhabited or not to be. So many of our buildings are meant to be striking from a distance, but rarely anyone thinks about what they might sound like or feel like to be in. And as you know, this discipline of acoustic ecology is making perfectly clear that we need sound to understand the health of the ecosystems in ways that eyes just won't do. So I suppose that's it. It's a kind of call to turn to the ear, I think.
Yeah. It's a neat analogy to your brother's best-selling book, Entangled Life, about how fungi really kind of bind so many different parts of our world together.
Absolutely, yeah.
Now, do you and he do a lot of work together?
Yeah, so I've been on a bunch of their field trips, either with the Fungi Foundation, an organization run by someone called Juliana Ferci, based in Chile, And also an organisation called SPUN, the Society for the Protection of Underground Networks. So I've sort of tagged along on a few of their expeditions to Patagonia and to Ecuador, and
with recorder in hand.
With
I'm
recorder
sure.
in hand, absolutely. So yeah, I've certainly spent some time recording subterranean sounds and spent some time rummaging through soils in far flung mm-hmm. places. Yeah.
And again, this theme of connection, it's more obvious in some songs than in others. The feet are the link is pretty much right there.
Mm-hmm. The hands, these are rooted feet, are the means of our shaping and grasping.
But also the song, I Stitched My Mind Back to My Body, one of my favorite tracks on the record. It has a kind of almost Afrobeat or New Orleans second line flavor to it.
Yeah, yeah, yes. yeah. I'm obsessed with New Orleans music, and I grew up, you know, from the age of 7 actually playing. My teacher was obsessed with Professor Longhair and Dr. John, and so I grew up from very early age just playing New Orleans music, really. Just Professor Longhair and Dr. John was kind of my diet. So and then I was lucky enough to spend some time when I was trying to write the first album. I went and spent a bit of time in New Orleans over Mardi Gras, and so it's just always been some sounds that are just big part of my the music I've grown up listening to, really. So it's hard to avoid. It's kind of drenched all over the album, really, the kind of New Orleans brass sound. And
yeah.
But there's definitely an Afrobeat flavor in the I Stitched My Mind Back to My Body. Yeah.
And that's another one of those songs that seems to have, well, I mean, I talked about a connecting thread, a stitch right in the title.
Mm-hmm.
Where in the process does that happen?
I mean, I suppose there are some things I know that the various areas of interest or exploration that seem to be, you know, overarching questions that guide a lot of the kind of inquiry. So there's always going to be themes that come from that. But in terms of specific songs or the way that I actually write, I often make the music first and the lyrics come very, very much at the end. And I'll start by just gibberish singing nonsense. And most of the time, like an image or a lyric will just flop out. and then I'll just kind of unpack that or follow the scent train of that. So, yeah, and then it's often very much after I've finished the song or after I've written the lyrics that there's a aha moment, and I suddenly realize what it all means or why that thing happened or these various images have come together. So it's normally the case that I realize what's going on after I've done it.
Yeah, yeah. I like that.
Yeah.
The record, The Much Much How How and I, is actually two records. It's the record of songs and then the same record of the instrumentals without the lyrics.
Mm-hmm.
So is that kind of reflecting what you just said, that's the process
for you? I suppose so. I mean, it wasn't exactly my thinking, but I suppose because there are so many kind of levels or layers to the music, often it's because they're built very much bit by bit, layer by layer. Often with the lyrics, they kind of take the focus quite a lot. So it's, for me, it's always been revealing listening to the songs without the lyrics, just because I can then I can hear the musical elements a little bit more. So I just thought it might be nice to put it out in that form as well.
Yeah. The song that ends the record is called Does the Swallow Dream of Flying? And it's one of several songs on the record that features a chorus. Mm-hmm. Who is that?
So this amazing this choir that I've been working with called Howl. It's a 9-piece female non-binary choir in the UK, and they're just wonderful, good friends and collaborators. And so right the way through writing of the record, I very much had them in mind for certain parts. And
Howl is
Howl.
The name. Oh, nice. All right, so with does the swallow dream of flying? If you're going to do this for us now, do you have Howl tucked away in a black box over there somewhere?
I do, unfortunately. Yeah, I've had to sample them and put them under a button, yeah.
It's fun to watch because, you know, someone comes in with backing tracks. It's usually hit a button and then sing. But your hands are going pretty much nonstop.
Well, I think for me, it's I always need to be able to make a mistake in order for it to feel fun for me because, I mean, and that's also a big part of if I'm playing a gig or there's, if I just press go and sing, then it's just, I think it's just, there's no tension, is there? There's no risk. So for me, it's like, I have to be able to fall flat on my face, get everything horribly wrong. And then there's tension and I have to pay attention. I have to be like present and it's way more fun for me, but it does result in sometimes it going horribly wrong. But, but no, I just try and resist as much as possible the pressing go just because, yeah, it's important for me to stay busy.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, off you go then. let's once again hear Cosmo Sheldrake performing live here in the studio. The song is called Does the Swallow Dream of Flying? From his brand new record called Eye to the Ear. Here's a live performance.
The swallow dream of flying as it sleeps on the wing. Does it long for the summer as it flies home for spring? Does Daisy feel a sadness at the last rays of sun? The wind feel a gladness at the work that it's done. I won't go making mountains out of molehills anymore. I won't go chasing windmills round in circles anymore. I won't go preaching sermons to the choir. What's it for? I won't go through the motions anymore. Does the river ever wonder what will come round the bend as it twists and meanders down its slow descent? I looked out over London with my last cup of tea. My gaze was returned by rain, cloud, and
Does the Swallow Dream of Flying? That is the song that concludes Cosmo Sheldrake's new album called Eye to the Ear. Just performed it here with a kind of virtual choir. Howl is the name of the choir from London. The title, Does the Swallow Dream of Flying? There was a New York Times article just recently about, you know, dreaming. And, you know, the idea that we know certain mammals dream, but the article was about how all but flightless birds seem to have some kind of REM thing happening in their brains, and that birds may indeed dream of flying.
Yeah. Well, it's a lovely thought, and I actually don't know whether it's... I know that swifts fly when they fly, when they migrate, but I can't guarantee that swallows do the same thing, but I've always just loved the idea of, yeah, if you're flying and sleeping and dreaming, are you dreaming of flying? Anyway, I love that thought.
And one of the other things they said in this article was that those long turns and, you know, gulls that travel thousands of miles on the wing, that half of the brain is asleep while the other half is navigating.
And that's a wild thought. Wow. But no, I just love, in general, just thinking about this, what other beings may think of or feel, and be that an animal or a river or a thing. Also, I've been involved over the last little while with an organization called MOTH, or the More Than Human Rights Project or Collective, actually based in NYU. And some of the various missions and adventures I've been on the last little while is very much in collaboration with the More Than Human Rights Collective stuff. And it's definitely been triggering some thoughts around how to expand, you know, the legal frameworks or the conceptual, the understanding of, you know, beingness, consciousness, whether, you know, and the various implications for other non-human entities having legal standing in some way. So I suppose it's just something I've been thinking about a lot, is the way in which rivers might think or feel, or how other non-human entities might engage and dream.
Yeah. You know, during the pandemic, there was a kind of a rise in musicians wondering how their music could be of use. Mm. You know, utility as something that is something to be strived for in art.
And absolutely.
It seems like, you know, you didn't need a pandemic to get there.
Well, I think something about functional music's been kind of left by the wayside a long time ago. I mean, obviously, there was an era when work songs were a genuine necessity to keep things in sync, or just a way of just surviving otherwise horribly grueling situations. But the conditions by which, you know, singing to unify or music in the workplaces. I mean, there's very few jobs that would tolerate that. Now, you can't really imagine people sitting in a bank sort of singing songs. There's a great essay by an essayist called G.K. Chesterton trying to imagine just that, speculating about what the modern work songs would be like.
And of course, as we go careering through the 21st century with, you know, 2 degrees centigrade staring us in the face, it's all the more important that this kind of usefulness
absolutely be
out there.
Totally.
The album's called Eye to the Ear. I do want to ask you about one final track, and that is the song called Run, which to me has just the vaguest whiff of Dumbo, of Pink Elephants on Parade.
Yeah, for sure.
Really?
Well, it came from... I was working with Cirque du Soleil, actually, just before the pandemic, and I was...
The circus that has no animals.
Yes, it certainly doesn't, But I was commissioned to write some music for a show that in the end it didn't work out, just because the pandemic kind of ground everything to a halt, and Cirque du Soleil had to go temporarily bankrupt just to make it through. But so it didn't really work out. But I'd got quite far down the line of writing some of the music for it, and that was one of the... It was from a kind of parade scene in this Cirque du Soleil show, and then I was just left with all this music that wasn't going to find us home in the Set the Soleil thing anymore. So I repurposed that one, but it very much did come from a kind of parade, circusy parade scene. So that's probably why it has the...
And then you superimpose lyrics.
And then I kind of wrote a song over the top. Yeah.
Yeah.
I'll run away. I ran away. I'll run away again. And then I'll come back home. I tried to stay.
We'll hear a little bit of that to wrap things up. Cosmo Sheldrake, it's been a long time, too long since you were last here. Thank you for coming in and playing for us today.
Thanks so much for having me back.
And down the hall in the video room, my thanks to Joe Enright, shooting videos of Cosmo's live performances. Our producer is Karen Havlick. Today's session produced by Laura Boyman, And as ever, Irene Trudell is our technical director. I'm John Schaefer. You can keep up with everything we're doing on New Sounds by subscribing to our free weekly newsletter. Simply text New Sounds to 70101 or sign up at newsounds.org.